Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio. Welcome to the show, fellow ridiculous historians. I've got to say, first, I'm Ben. Hi.
Oh, hey, Ben. It's me, Noel, your old pal.
And there's our super producer, Casey Pegram.
Hello.
We're in a different studio today. Just peek behind the curtain. So Casey's actually physically sitting in the same room with us.
It's weird. I have to be quiet and not make noise.
I know.
Can't be crinkling a wrapper
or
something.
And you're craning your neck to look at us from the side. Yeah. And we have a really, and we can smell each other's musks.
Absolutely.
I mean, this is a very small little hot box that we're in right now.
Sorry, the musk might be me.
Oh, no. It's a melange of all of our musks. Mm-hmm. And all of our musks combined, we are Ridiculous History.
A potpourri of perfect ridiculousness. Yeah. Did you guys see the movie, what was it with Forrest Whitaker? Was it Ghost Dog?
Way of the Samurai? With the RZA soundtrack? Mm-hmm. Or was it GZA?
I think it was RZA.
RZA's soundtrack.
That's right.
GZA does production, but is more, I think, known for his verses.
When Wu-Tang forms like Voltron, I believe that RZA is the head.
I just saw RZA in the new Jim Jarmusch movie.
Oh, yeah? How'd he do?
He was great for his scene. I had issues with the movie.
I heard the movie was very, painfully self-aware.
Yeah. But no, he's, got a little cameo. He's with WPS. So he makes a delivery. Nice. That's pretty much it.
That's great. I'm still a Jarmusch addict, so I'll check out Dead Don't Die. But this is interesting because in the concept of Ghost Dog, right, is that he is a samurai and people are often taken aback because they're thinking, how can this black man be a samurai?
Well, but to be fair, he's also a modern day kind of self-prescribed samurai, isn't he?
Right. He does it. He's not dressed as a samurai in the 16th century would be.
But today we're going to talk about a historical Ghost Dog kind of figure, mm-hmm. right?
Yes, Yasuke, the enslaved African man who became a samurai and fought for Nobunaga. Also, soft note to any of our Japanese-speaking friends, any of your fellow Japanese-speaking listeners in the audience, none of us speak Japanese.
Should we have brought in Lauren Vogelbaum as a Japanese consultant on this one?
You know, I thought about it, Noel, but I didn't want to spring it on her at the last minute.
She's still recovering from jet lag from Hawaii.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We welcomed her back yesterday, and it was bittersweet because, I said, welcome back. I'm sorry you had to leave Hawaii.
I just sang her the Welcome Back, Cotter song
mm-hmm.
with open arms.
Nice.
And then we shared a whiskey. You were there.
I was there. Yeah. I was there. I said aloha. She said mahalo.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the extent of my Hawaiian language
knowledge.
You
left it at that. And just so you know, our knowledge of the Japanese language is similarly light. But we're going to do our best on these here pronunciations. Here's the thing. It's not unheard of in the history of the samurai for non-Japanese individuals to reach the heights, work their way up to the ranks of the samurai. You may have seen that Tom Cruise movie, The Last Samurai?
The Last Samurai. I have problems with that film.
Well, isn't it kind of a white savior narrative a little bit?
It's like Blood Diamond. And Blood Diamond is this very similar thing with Leonardo DiCaprio. Someone is killing a bunch of people, but then they do one decent thing, and because they happen to be white, they're praised.
And if I'm not mistaken, don't they both do bad accents in both of those movies?
My favorite Afrikaner or South African accent is Leonardo DiCaprio. They have a word for people like me, Ubuntu. It means white man in Africa.
Ooh. Wow.
That's the accent is so terrible that I did a pretty good job of what Leonardo DiCaprio was doing.
Isn't Ubuntu also a type of Linux software?
I was going to say it's a Linux distro.
I think it is. But if I'm not mistaken, so English sailor William Adams, mm-hmm. Who was born in 1564, died in 1620, came to Japan in 1600, and he did just what we said, rose through the ranks and became himself a very notable samurai. But he was English. Didn't Tom Cruise not do an English accent in the movie, if I'm not mistaken? I don't remember.
I don't think so.
Okay.
And then I was watching it, I think on a plane or something. Yeah, this guy, the English guy, comes after Yasuke.
That's right. And he's just the most famous, because I've never heard of Yasuke.
Yeah, he's just the most famous. There was also one from shortly after Yasuke's period, who was from South Korea. There were several from South Korea. There was one guy from the Netherlands. And then there was William Adams, you mentioned. And then there was a Chinese national. And then there was one who was unknown.
Oh, the unknown samurai. That'd be a good movie.
That's a great idea.
Just name cool alone. Name. Let's just start with the name and work backwards. But no, we have this gentleman whose name is Yasuke. And I can only imagine that was his name that he was given after coming to Japan.
Right,
and becoming
yeah.
But they refer to him in all the research that we've seen as that from the start. So we don't know what his name was before this, but I can only assume that that's the case. Would you agree?
Yeah, yeah. Or it's at the very least, it's a Japanization of his original name. So we have a couple of theories about his life, but we don't really know anything for certain about his original life before he arrived in Japan. According to some books, people just sort of assumed that he was from Portuguese-controlled Mozambique, because a lot of the people of color who were traveling to Japan from Africa were coming from Mozambique.
No, that's right, because he was an enslaved person.
Yes.
And he was traveling with a group of Europeans, or I believe a gentleman from Portugal, and he was sort of like a manservant to this, was it a Jesuit? It was some kind of religious, a member of a religious order, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, yes. He arrived in 1579 as the servant of a Jesuit missionary, Alessandro Valigano. And Alessandro had been appointed what they called the visitor or the inspector of Jesuit missions in the Indies. So that was South and East Asia and East Africa. So he would travel around to all the missions owned by the Jesuits.
And a lot of this research comes from a gentleman named Thomas Lockley, who wrote a book called African Samurai, The True Story of Yasuke, a Legendary Black Warrior in Feudal Japan. And Ben, as you said at the top of the show, one of the theories is that he came from Mozambique. Others suggest that he came from Sudan. And trained as a child soldier in Goa in India.
Right, right. The idea being that because of his, to the Japanese, extraordinary height, he's about a foot taller than the average Japanese person, and because of his very, very dark skin, he might have been a member of the Dinka in Sudan. So let's stick with Lockley for a second. This is all speculative. There are no corroborating documents on Yasuke's time. His agreed-upon adventure, as far as the documents go, really does kind of begin in Japan. But Lockley spent 9 years researching the story of this man, Yasuke. And he believes that Yasuke was abducted from his family by slave traders, either of Arab or Indian origin, and then trafficked across the Indian Ocean through Arab countries. And as you said, Noel, trained as a child soldier. And it's during this time that Lockley speculates Yasuke meets Alessandro Valigano, the most powerful Jesuit missionary of the day. So Goa was a huge trading, missionary, military hub.
Coastal.
Yeah, for the Portuguese empires. And it was a huge center of the slave trade. So it's quite plausible that this is where the Jesuits encounter Yasuke for the first time, right?
Yep, I agree completely. Let's backtrack just a little bit and give a little bit of context of what was going on in 16th century Japan at the time. Huge divides going on, a lot of isolation from the outside world. The country was split into various provinces, and they were ruled by these feudal lords that were, okay, I'm going to do my best on this one. They were called, I think it's daimyos, and this is, of course, a nation that is an island, so it has a lot of water that causes it to be isolated in that way. So it really creates its own kind of universe, very isolated. And that is until European explorers, you know, with ships and fleets seeking adventure, decided to make their way into this, what they thought saw as a very exotic land that they either wanted to conquer or, you know, learn from, or I don't know what the motivation. What do you think, Ben?
They didn't have the most successful results at first. The Portuguese were the first Europeans to arrive in Japan, and they brought their entire culture with them, which included the religion and included slavery.
And it included our hero, Yasuke.
So as we established, Yasuke arrives in Japan in 1581, and his arrival triggers a literal riot. He lands in Kyoto, and people wanted to see this extraordinary person and be in his presence because they had never seen anything like this. And the next few pieces of this story may be offensive to some listeners, but I have personal insight on this too, because this happened to some of my friends when they went to rural China.
Oh, no way.
Yeah, yes way. Yes way, Ted. So there's a warlord, the most powerful warlord in Japan, Nobunaga Oda, and he sees Yasuke, and at first he believes this is not a human being. It's either a demon or a god, a Daiko Kuten, or god of prosperity, because they're usually represented by black statues in temples. And so this is what he does. He tries to rub what he thinks is ink off of this man's skin and makes him like strip to his waist and then try to rub it off him. And then he goes, oh, my God.
He's fascinated by the man.
Yeah. He's like, this is your skin. This is not paint or ink. This has happened within our lifetimes to people in rural China. I had a friend who was traveling out toward Western China. Some older person came up. And without so much as a buy your leave, they grabbed my pal's arm and they spat on his arm. Ugh. And tried to rub off the skin. And they didn't think it was mean. And afterwards, they wanted pictures with him.
Well,
they wanted to talk.
Spitting on people is never polite behavior. I wouldn't say.
No. I can't.
There has to be a better way to do that.
Culture where that's appropriate, but this is true. We can kind of see, if we exercise some empathy, how amazing this must be. This guy is taller than literally everyone. His skin seems amazing to you, right? And once Oda is finally convinced that this Yasuke character is real, he immediately throws a feast for the guy, and it turns from a riot to a party. Also, again, these are warlord rules, so he pretty much decides the tone of the room.
Oh, totally. And the riot element you're talking about, I think, referred to folks trying to get a look at the guy, right?
Yes, yeah, exactly.
So literally just like a kind of feeding frenzy to kind of like, oh, see. Because, it's important to remember, this certainly would have been one of the first, if not the first, many of these folks had ever seen of a black man.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is not necessarily a movie moment where it's like Oda is at the Kyoto port. Lord Nobunaga, as he was called, asked for an audience when he heard about all this commotion. And that's when he does the whole thing about rubbing the pigment from his skin and then throwing his feast. And then he hires Yasuke. He makes him his retainer and his bodyguard.
Yes, he did eventually make him his bodyguard. For a little while, though, he was treated a little bit more as like a kind of like a source of amusement, or kind of like a novelty, kind of an oddity, right?
I see.
But then he demonstrated, because of his training, right, as a child soldier and his military prowess, he demonstrated very quickly that he was a very competent and powerful warrior. And he began to learn martial arts as well.
Right. And he was also versed in Japanese. So we think he probably had these conversations. According to Lockley, Oda loved just sitting around and shooting the breeze with Yasuke, you know, tell me more about your life. There are no records of how much he earned at his time, you know, when he was first sort of a novelty, and then when within a month he's a warrior. We don't know how much he was paid, so Lockley says it's tough to know how high Yasuke ranked. And that's why you'll hear a lot of people, including this author, speculate that he was the equivalent of a page or a bodyguard.
That's right. But what we do know is a Tokyo-based publisher by the name of Matt Alt, who works for a publishing house called Alt Japan, had this to say, that Yasuke was no longer seen as human chattel or any kind of like indentured servant, but he was like all vassals, meaning, you know, a samurai is beholden to their lord, the warlord, Oda, yeah. Right?
Right. And that's why in less than a year, Yasuke went from being a page to becoming one of the upper echelons of Japan's warrior class, the samurai. We should stop just for a second and talk about what a samurai actually is, because I suspect that many of us may have a couple of misconceptions. So these are warriors of pre-modern Japan, and later they become the military ruling class and the highest-ranking social caste of the Edo period, which is 1603-1867. They had this sort of code, right? A code by which one would live, maybe similar to the idea of chivalry, but this was Confucian in design, right? Or in influence. This Bushido, the way of the warrior, stressed things like loyalty to your master, self-discipline, respectful, ethical behavior, and there was also a lot of Zen Buddhism in there. But these might be filling any number of roles. You know, some samurai eventually essentially became bureaucrats. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. But
not at this time.
No, not at this time. But Yusuke was literally Oda's, like, right-hand man. Mm-hmm. He got all of this special treatment, preferential treatment. He was gifted a ceremonial samurai sword or a katana sword. He dined privately, regularly with Oda, which was very enviable among the other samurai. He was kind of his favorite, it would seem, based on what we know. He also had his own private residence, which wasn't for everybody. And just seemed to be a real asset to the warlord and have a really prominent position in that society.
Right. And again, when we're talking about the society, we have to emphasize this is a fractured society. This is not the unified Japan with which we are familiar today. There's a lot of interior fighting. This is the era of warring states. It's a turbulent century in history. And just in the same way that the Alamo or Antietam conjures these images of generals and founding fathers, so do the key struggles of this period, also called the Sengoku, according, again, to Alt. And Yusuke knows that he is not going to have, he might have a future when he's older as some sort of bureaucrat if he makes it, but in this very violent time, he's going to fight. So within a year of his arrival, he joins Lord Nobunaga's forces in their invasion of the Iga province, IGA. And they attacked this place, which is ringed with mountains. It was called a ninja hotbed with 40,000 to 60,000 troops, and they conquered it.
Yeah, and this is from Lockley's account. He said that this first foray into battle was a success. His second, there was kind of a twist in the story, right? So according to Lockley's account, in June of 1582, Nobunaga's samurai general, Mitsuhide Akichi, attacked his master, Nobunaga, at his residence in Kyoto. He launched a tactical, you know, offensive. The attack kicked off something that's known as the Battle of Honnoji Temple. And that kind of put the kibosh on Nobunaga's plans to bring together these splintered factions in Japan, right? Mm-hmm. He wanted to unify the country.
Under his control, as most warlords do.
That's fair.
You know what would make this place great if I were in charge?
That'd be swell.
It doesn't take warlords to think that way, but most do.
Yep.
So it's a tragic, dramatic moment in Japanese history and in Yasuke's personal history. He is fighting tooth and nail during this siege, this storming of the temple. And when Lord Nobunaga sees that defeat appears imminent and unavoidable, he goes back to his thinking of the code under which he has functioned for most of his life. And he says, this general has betrayed me, so I have no choice but to commit seppuku, or ritual suicide.
And that's when, I mean, it's a very specific way of killing oneself, and it's pretty grisly. Oh, it gives me the heebie-jeebies just talking about it, thinking about it.
You're disemboweling yourself.
You're disemboweling yourself with a very specific short blade. You stick it in, and then you pull it sideways, and essentially your guts just spill out wherever you stand, and then you fall over dead. I imagine it wouldn't be a quick death.
And if it's something where enemy forces are giving you the option to choose that honorable way out— I believe the idea was that you were given the option of using the short knife, and if you faltered or you didn't do it correctly or you hesitated, there would be someone standing next to you or nearby with a sword, and they would decapitate you.
Yeah, in fact, Oda's last order to Yasuke was to take his sword and his decapitated head to his son. Wow. That's daddy. Oh, yeah. My God. So that's grisly.
Yasuke probably took the head after the guy died, after right. Lord Nobunaga died. And he had to take this head because it couldn't fall into someone else's hands. It was considered very dishonorable. So he goes back to Azuchi Castle and starts working for Nobunaga's son, Odo Nobutada. His son also committed suicide after suffering defeat at the hands of the same treacherous general.
That's right. And at this point, Yasuke is what we call a ronin, or what the Japanese refer to as a ronin, which is a samurai without a master. And that's an image that you see throughout, you know, cinema and, like, fiction, the idea of the roving, wandering ronin who sure. is beholden to no one, and you think of them as almost like a vigilante of justice out to, you know, right wrongs or whatever. I don't know.
Or the crime film with Robert De Niro.
Also that.
I don't know. I can't. I don't even remember what happened at Ronin, but I remember being a little unimpressed. Maybe I need to watch it again. Maybe I was too young.
I don't know that I ever saw that. And this is where we kind of lose the plot on Yasuke a little bit, right? Lockley does some more of his speculation that he knows and loves so well. The idea is that Yasuke could have possibly gone back to the Jesuit missionaries.
Who knows? He could have been a guard for the Jesuits, but he could have been a sailor. He could have been a pirate.
That'd be fun.
It's just dream big.
He just needed a change. You know, the whole, like, handing over the decapitated head of his master to the son, that probably would have turned him a little bit.
Well, let's step back a little bit, too, and see that although Lord Nobunaga was pretty progressive and seen past color, Mitsuhide was super racist. He said, this Yasuke character is not human. He's not Japanese. He's not even human. He's a beast. And I refuse to acknowledge him as a samurai. Mm. And he said the problem with this, one of the reasons he was so offended, probably racism, right. xenophobia.
Yeah,
but another reason is that Yasuke did not commit seppuku, which was the Eastern tradition. Instead, he offered his sword to the general, which is Western tradition.
Interesting. So you think it really is kind of the case that Oda, the original master, was a pretty progressive dude for the time.
In this instance.
In this instance. What I'm saying is the way he was treated would not have been the norm. He kind of went out on a limb, you know, but if you think about it too, I mean, yes, they obviously became friends, but his primary impetus was probably like, look at this big strapping dude that I can put to work for me, you know?
Yeah.
So there's a little bit of racism even in that.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. That's the thing. It's sort of like Frederick Wilhelm would have said that he loved the Potsdam Giants and was good friends with them, right? But he would still kill them if they didn't do what he wanted.
Of course.
So this is almost where the tale ends. Despite his relatively brief time as a samurai, he's been a hero in fiction, and a lot of stuff has been based off of him, including the great animated series Afro Samurai.
So good.
Loosely based.
Sure. Yeah, 100%.
So loosely based in that it just happens to be a samurai.
And the thing, too, is there may have been others like him, but we just don't have the same kind of documentation that we do about mm-hmm. him. He was pictured in a lot of traditional Japanese screen paintings where he stands out among the crowd. You can definitely tell there's like one black person among all of these mm-hmm. Japanese folks. And he appears multiple times, right?
Right, right. There's some, I guess, compelling stuff, but it's circumstantial. This is the best documented case we have of this sort of contact. There is another figure in Japanese history that some experts will say is of African descent, a fellow named Sakanoye no Tamoramaro.
That's a tough one, Ben. You did very well.
I did a horrible, piss-poor job
on that. I disagree.
Well, thank you. He was a warrior who, from about 758 to 811 AD, was a palace guard. And he was placed in command of forces that the emperor had sent to fight the indigenous people, the Ainu. This warrior was said to have a black complexion. But that's kind of grasping at straws. You know what I mean? There's no one who said this guy came from Africa.
And lest we have dropped too many spoilers in this, there is a pretty amazing looking dramatization of this story that's coming to Netflix in the not too far future, where Yatsuke is going to be played by Chadwick Boseman of Black Panther fame.
Yes, that's right. Phenomenal actor. And Yasuke does not have a release date yet. The news on the street is just news about casting, but I'm going to watch it. I mean, I already have Netflix. It's kind of a sunk cost, right? What am I going to do, not watch it?
Exactly. No, you're not going to not watch it.
Right.
Yeah. And, you know, I am very much looking forward to it now that Game of Thrones has let us all down so hard. And also, you know, just the fact that it's gone. Like, the fact that it was a disappointing ending is neither here nor there. I need something to fill the vacuum that is my Sunday night and the hole in my heart.
I'm just waiting for the books. I don't think the story's over because there are still two more books. If you're listening, George R.R. Martin, know you're a big fan of the show. Maybe that's it. Maybe George, if you're listening, maybe you've just been so busy listening to Ridiculous History that you haven't had time to sit down and write those other two novels. If so, we apologize to every Song of Ice and Fire fan out there.
Yeah, it's all our fault.
It's mainly Casey's.
Wow. We got a very non-committal nod there.
We did.
It's okay. What else we got?
Well, it's this is the end of our episode, but not the end of our show. We'd like to hear your stories of other, let's say, unorthodox outsiders who made a name for themselves in society, similar to the way Yasuke did. You know what I mean? And this could traverse gender, ethnicity, religious creed. Let us not forget that religious differences that seem relatively minor to a lot of us today in an increasingly secular United States were huge deals for thousands of years.
It's true. It's true. Yeah, write us in. Give us your stories of outsiders making a splash. You can write to us at ridiculous@iheartradio.com. You can also hit us up on our Facebook group, The Ridiculous Historians, where I think all you have to do is name either me, Ben, or Casey, or just say something cute.
Or, yeah, just make one of us laugh.
Uh-huh.
Yes, you can also find us on our Twitters, on our Instagram. You can find our personal adventures on Twitter or Instagram. I'm at Ben Bolin HSW on Twitter, and I'm at Ben Bolin on Instagram.
I don't really tweet too much. I occasionally lurk in other people's tweets, but not my thing. So I am pretty exclusively on Instagram at HowNowNoelBrown. Big thanks to super producer Casey Pegram for holding it down in the sweatbox. Big thanks to Alex Williams, who composed our theme.
Big thanks to Gabe Luzier. Big thanks to Christopher Hasiotis. Big thanks to you for listening, and extra big thanks to you, Noel.
I return your thanks with thanks of my own for you and all you do for the, just, you know, history at large.
One day, this is so weird, I have this dream. It has nothing to do with anything. I have this dream of throwing like an old-fashioned pizza party for us and all the Ridiculous Historians. You know, like where you would rent out a skating rink or bowling alley. I just got to find the right location. Tell us if you'd be down for that.
Totally. We should totally do a meetup. Maybe we should get on the Historians page and see if there's enough folks in Atlanta to hang out sometime.
Let's check it out.
We'll see you soon, folks. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.